Continuing education is more essential and more strategically valuable than ever. The old model of front-loaded education is no longer viable. Today's learners need relevant and flexible CE to keep pace.
And we have a free resource to help your learning business provide that kind of high-impact learning. The Strategic CE Playbook introduces a practical framework to help you strategically design and deliver continuing education programs that will succeed in today's complex and competitive market.
The playbook focuses on three essential levers: personalization, portfolio thinking, and performance.
To learn more about the three levers and how to use them effectively, get your copy of the Strategic CE Playbook at leadinglearning.com/strategic-CE.
If you're a leader or an aspiring leader in the business of lifelong learning, you're in the right place. I'm Salisa Steele.
And I'm Jeff Cobb, and this is the Leading Learning Podcast.
We recently recorded what's become an annual tradition. This is the third year that we've done a learning trends and learning predictions webinar, and we thought it would be good to talk about some of the concepts and topics that we raised in that webinar here on the podcast.
Yeah, and I'll say before we jump into those, it was amazing to see how many people showed up for that podcast. We had
webinar.
Webinar, that's right. Hopefully, the same number are going to show up for this podcast. But we had about 350 people sign up for that webinar. That's become increasingly popular over the years, and you know, we talk about what we see as major learning trends and make some forecast predictions for going forward. And so, we thought we'd highlight two of those in this episode. One of them being a concept we're calling grand design learning, and another one being boutique learning. So two takes on learning that organizations in the learning business might want to think about and tune into in the coming years.
So Jeff, why don't you start by telling us just a little bit about design thinking, which sort of underlies your prediction for the grand design learning?
Yeah, design thinking was really the trend that I tuned into, and not really a new trend. It's been around for a while. Certainly folks in the software world in particular have been thinking about design thinking for a while, and I think it's most associated with the firm IDEO, which is a creative firm that's been involved in all sorts of projects, and its founder, David Kelly, who came out of the Stanford Design School. But you know, I see design thinking is really just a term that's become trendy for a fairly common sense way of creating value. So basically, you observed what people actually do, you know, what their situation actually is. You explore the possibilities for improving that situation, and then you create testable solutions, and you keep improving upon those based on your testing. So it's very human involved. You know, it's not just we think we know what the problem is and here's a solution and we're going to impose it. There's a good bit of ambiguity. You go out and explore, and again, you know, based on testing, you're going to develop your solutions. Works very well with software design. I think it also works very well with learning.
Well, it sounds like ties into a concept that I know we've written about a lot, the minimum viable product.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the minimum viable product is an outgrowth of design thinking. I don't know that I've ever heard that actually said, but clearly, you know, it's based on those you know, same sorts of principles. And I think, you know, any trend like this catches on because, you know, there's something to it. There's something fundamental that's somehow been, you know, forgotten or lost that we just need to revive. And I think design thinking overall is just an attempt to take a much more human-centered approach, you know, in anything we do, and certainly with what we're talking about, you know, in how we think about designing and developing learning experiences. We want to be, you know, make sure that we truly are tuning into the learner situation all the time when we're developing learning and being very intentional about that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good lip service paid to being learner-centered, but I think the design thinking really gives you a way to make sure that you're doing that.
Yeah. And so, you know, one of the things we got asked on the webinar that certainly wanted to make sure we highlight here is, you know, to get some examples of design thinking as we head towards what I'm have termed kind of grand design learning that the organizations may want to think about. So, you know, an example, and I'll preface this by saying that design thinking is really everywhere. And I think it's kind of artificial to say, oh, this problem was solved by design thinking and this problem was solved by a more, you know, analytical approach. That's almost never the case. I mean, there are elements of design thinking in just about everything. There are elements of more, you know, analytical, traditional problem solving approaches in just about anything, you know, and trying to tease them apart as that sort of, you know, angels on the head of a pin sort of thing. But that said, you know, some things are clearly a little more design oriented in their approach than others. And so, you know, one scenario I'll highlight, and this is one that often I think gets highlighted in the context of talking about design thinking, is to look at a problem like childhood obesity and, you know, how you might approach something like that. And, you know, there's a firm, I believe it was that Daylight, I think is the name of the firm that kind of worked on this and took a design approach. But, you know, they wanted to be able to get kids to move more, basically, is, you know, that's kind of underlying the obesity problem, is kids just aren't necessarily getting enough exercise. So how do you address that? And so, you know, they started out with an idea, with a theory. And this is often the case with the design thinking. You've got an idea. You think you've got something you want to test out or that's going to work, but you do want to test it out. Sometimes it's much more ambiguous than that. You really have no idea and you're just going to kind of dive in and see what the possibilities are. But in this case, I mean, they had an idea. They were going to provide kids with a digital music player that had a motion sensor in it and then provide rewards based on the kids, you know, listening to music and moving, and then the kid, you know, gets something as a result of having done that. So the question was, you know, are kids going to do this? If we're going to give them this kind of music player, you know, are they actually going to use it? Are they going to use it long enough to actually get any kind of health benefits? So they wanted to take that theory out there and test it. And again, testing is very, you know, that's the center of design-based thinking. So they got out there and they spent time, you know, talking to and probably more importantly, watching kids in different places across the country, in their homes and at schools, and just trying to learn from what they were actually doing, you know, figuring out what their motivations were, what their habits were, what kind of things really got them, you know, excited and delighted, what kinds of things were frustrating them. And they looked at average kids, so, you know, what you would expect a typical kid to be doing in terms of movement. But then they also looked at, you know, kind of the super movers, the kids who were really, really active, and then the more sedentary kids, and they tried to, you know, factor in all of those into their thinking, and they found out that the kids who were kind of more at the extremes, those who were, you know, the super movers or the really sedentary ones, often were much better at kind of articulating some of the key problems and frustrations and the things that made them excited, you know, about moving. So they were able to take that and working with those kids, and based on, you know, capturing, you know, tons of observations, and they put all these on post-it notes, and design thinking can be very visual. You know, you want to capture stuff and put it together in a way that people can look at it. So they put all the post-it notes up for, you know, the group that was working on it to look at, and from that they extracted patterns, and they were looking for, you know, the opportunities that were there. And, you know, some of the things that emerged, a lot of things emerged, but some of the key ones were that, you know, kids really liked socially oriented games. They didn't really necessarily like the solo game where they did something and then got, you know, told that was a good thing. They wanted it to be in more of a social situation, like a lot of, you know, multiplayer video games are these days. You know, people are playing video games socially across the internet. And they also didn't necessarily like wearing something like an iPod and listening to music when they were exercising, because they wanted to be able to talk with their friends. And so they didn't necessarily have on earphones and things like that. They were actually communicating. So those are two big clues, and they got other clues out of it. But, you know, that led to a design principle. And at the core of design thinking is that you find these patterns, and then you pull your design principles out of those patterns that you're actually seeing the people that you're trying to serve involved in. And in this case, you know, social interaction and being able to facilitate social interaction through whatever the solution was going to be was a clear design principle for them to embrace. And there were other design principles, but that's a key one that came out of this. So they moved from there into, you know, specific ideas and prototypes. And, you know, in this case, they made some cardboard prototypes and drawings and things that the kids could actually react to and play with. And again, they observed that as they moved towards what they were actually going to create. And what they wound up with was not the digital music player that they, you know, thought they were going to create from the beginning, but actually a very small activity monitor that could be clipped onto somebody's, you know, belt or just, you know, the side of their pants, could be put into their pockets. And that would actually, you know, track the activity that a kid was engaged in, but then it was easily uploadable into a portal where that could be shared. The data could be shared. Stories around that data could be shared with peers, with family. You know, this is a while back. You can already see sort of the Fitbit type thing emerging here, and
We have an 8-year-old who's fascinated with the Fitbit, and I can see how watching kids you would get to this idea. And then they took that, after they came out with this activity monitor, did a clinical trial for 6 months and saw a 59% improvement in the rate of activity among the kids that were actually using the monitor. So that's a way of starting with an idea, but really going out and really involving yourself with the audience that you're trying to serve, observing them, talking with them, and then testing out some ideas based on what you're getting back from them. It sounds very simple, but we all know that most of the time we're just not as conscious of that. We're not as intentional about doing that as we should be, and particularly for any sort of learning experience. And this was fundamentally a learning experience that we're talking about here. That kind of thinking is instrumental.
Well, I think it also is important to think about, like you said, it's not all that hard, but it does take time. And so making sure that you're allowing for that type of interplay with the learners that you're seeking to serve, you've got to build that into your development timeline.
Definitely. Somebody in the webinar asked, how does this change the instructional designer's role? And for me, the instructional designer becomes a much more active person. I mean, you're out there in the field, you're in the arena, so to speak, you're in the midst of things, and you're collecting that data. And then, you're going back and collaborating and sharing and talking this through. This is a very collaborative sort of process. You're both interacting with your audience, but then also, the people who are coming up with the ideas are typically collaborating together to do that as well. And so, where this then tips into what I'm calling grand design thinking is when you look at the world of learning and what's going on out there in the whole landscape right now, on the one hand, we've seen just this really, huge explosion in the different formats and the channels that are available. So you've got mobile, you've got micro, you've got, massive open online courses, MOOCs, gamification, you've got social learning, you've got informal learning. So all of these different options now. And you've also got opportunities of scale, like I've never been there before. I already referenced, massive open online courses, but all sorts of ways to reach, massive groups of learners. And then I think you combine that with what's a central theme for us here on the Leading Learning Podcast and with our Leading Learning efforts in general. And that is the concept of, trying to lead learning broadly across whatever field, industry, sector, audience that you're serving. So bring all of those three factors together. And I think, as we think about learning and the design of learning going forward, I characterize it as thinking in terms of the grand design of whatever we're creating. And that takes really kind of two forms. One is grand just in the sense of being able to connect all of those dots that I just referenced, the formats, the channels, the broad base of learners that you might be able to access now, and being able to connect all those in a way that, brings them together and creates a learning experience that's, not just about a course, that's not just about a conference, that's not just about a webinar, that's not even just about, an online community or less formal type of learning, but really combines all of those things in a way that optimally realizes the possibilities for the learner and helps them to, really have an impactful learning experience. And I think that really is thinking about the process of learning on a grander scale and really incorporating together the pieces that are available. And the other way I think about grand, and this is even bigger grand, this is in the, kind of aligns with the obesity issue that we talked about earlier, is that, most organizations that are serving an industry or a field want to create change in that industry or field. They want to address a significant problem or a significant opportunity. They want to be able to raise the bar, move the dial across the sector that they're serving. And I think to create that sort of large-scale change, that's where this grand design learning comes into play, and using design thinking in that way to say, okay, we are really going to tackle this significant issue or this significant opportunity across our sector because we are thinking about design in a way that incorporates all of the possibilities that are now available to us in creating learning experiences. So that's, that's the bones of grand design. I think this is a concept we'll be digging into a lot over time. We're just kind of at the beginning of thinking about it right now. But raised that during the webinar. It got a lot of interest. We got a lot of dialogue around that, a lot of good questions. And so we're looking forward to exploring that one more going forward.
And so the other
prediction that we talked about in the webinar that we want to touch on in this podcast is boutique learning, which is a term that we came up with. And just as the grand design thinking that you talked about, Jeff, came out of this kind of design thinking trend, boutique learning is sort of our prediction for the future based on the current personalized learning trend. And again, that's not a new trend, certainly been around a long time. Personalized learning is basically this idea that you're going to tailor the curriculum or the learning environment to the learners so that it's appropriate for those learners, their different learning needs or different goals with learning. And I think increasingly personalization of learning has come to rely on technology. And I know that this year I've just seen a lot of that come across. I'm thinking about Newton as it's putting forth a lot of curriculum in the sort of K through 12 space, and really it's gotten pretty sophisticated with its algorithms and just kind of the breadth and depth of its content so that it can make some recommendations to students there happen very quickly and easily. And I think it's a great thing in many ways that technology has made personalized learning much more of a reality, because one of the, I think, hindrances to personalized learning has always just been how much time it would take to, you know, sit down and really develop a personalized curriculum for, you know, every individual learner. That's just usually prohibitive for the facilitator or teacher. So technology has gotten a lot better with some of those algorithms and automated recommendations, and that's great in many ways, but it also seems like
there are downsides.
It seems like there's some risks there that, you know, if we are relying solely on technology, then we're sort of eliminating the human from that learning equation. And we just know how important social is for learning, how there's that human to human contact that often drives learning. Even in that obesity example you were sharing, it's that the kids wanted to talk and interact.
Yeah, and it's funny, I think in both of these trends, predictions that that we're talking about here, you know, there's this tension, there's this interplay between the technological possibilities and the human at the center of it, and just making sure that that you do stay focused on the human, that, you know, the technology gets leveraged for the possibilities that it creates, but it doesn't dominate in the end.
And so the idea with boutique learning is that it would really be more about personal learning rather than personalized learning, mm-hmm. just to kind of use that linguistic difference there. You know, I think theization of it kind of being all the technology there, and that it, despite the fact that it's personal, it also can seem a little bit more removed because it does often lack that human element.
Beware the ization. That might be our tagline for this podcast.
And so, you know, with boutique learning, it really is about a focus on the personal. And if we just, you know, if we look to, say, retail, which is kind of where the whole term boutique came out of, if you think about actual boutique shops, I mean, they differ from traditional retailers in a few ways. And one of those ways is size, right? You know, the boutique store is smaller than your big box store. And so I think that that's an element of boutique learning, is that it has to be kind of smaller in scale than, you know, your massive, you know, 50,000 attendee, conference or event. It needs to be something smaller on scale so it can feel more personal. Again, in the retail world, you think about the inventory. The boutique shops don't offer everything. They're not the one-stop shops. They offer a much more limited inventory. So I think with boutique learning, then there's a focus on a specialized audience or clientele, and then the inventory, the products and services that are really going to serve that audience, that clientele. Boutique shops, I was reading one place where they were talking about the difference between kind of, again, the larger retailers and boutiques, and they were talking about the difference often comes down to a company versus product passion. So this idea that, you know, boutique stores often come out of the founder's kind of really passion for whatever it is, you know, so if they love wine, then, you know, that's behind their boutique wine store. Whereas you have, if you have the larger retailers, it's usually more driven by just kind of
that passion for the company, for building a company, for, you know, the kind of pure entrepreneurial, generic entrepreneurial sort of dream there. And I thought that was a really interesting point, because I think that too could apply to boutique learning, in the sense of, I think it's really got to be that passion about serving that particular clientele with that inventory you have. And I think it gets, actually, I think this ties in very nicely to that grand design thinking around kind of that moving the dial, that grand part of it. You know, what is your passion? What is it that you want to drive? What change do you want to make? What impact do you want to have? And so I think that's a good differentiator too.
Yeah, and I'll pick up on two threads there. You know, one is that kind of passion thread. And, you know, when I think about boutique learning, there are a lot of parallels that can be drawn between what's happened in the music business and what's happening in the learning business in terms of scale and digitalization. And, you know, you got iTunes out there. You can get anything anytime with music, just like you can go online and get just about any course on anything at this point. But it's been funny, in the midst of everything that's happened with music and digitization, what's come back very strongly. Mm-hmm. Vinyl records. I think vinyl, you know, is the boutique arena of music, and that's where people get very, very passionate. So I think passion is something to look for. And then I think, you know, for so many organizations, boutique is going to involve what they are really uniquely good at. It really gets to the heart of their value proposition. And we talk a lot about the value ramp, and we'll include some links to that in the show notes, and this idea that, you know, there's a certain portion of your portfolio that's very high value and can typically be, you know, much higher price than everything else, and that it's hard for anybody to get anywhere else. And I think, you know, that's a place where boutique learning fits in extremely well. And I think, you know, organizations increasingly need, you know, you're going to continue your conferences. We're not saying, you know, get rid of your online course catalog, but I think increasingly to look for those opportunities in boutique learning that really stand you out, because those are what's going to help build your brand. Those are what's going to help bring people to the other parts of your portfolio.
Yeah, and I think on that upper end of the value ramp, I mean, you know, that's where it's one of a kind, and that's very different than the one-stop shop, you know, so one of a kind rather than one stop. And to your point too, again, right, we're not saying you have to get rid of maybe some more of the big retailer type approaches to education. I mean, you have boutique brands that exist as basically sub-brands. I was looking at the Nobu Hotel, which is basically like a separate hotel within Caesar's Palace. You know, so it has different check-in and different feel and all of that. So, I mean, I think where I see it probably fitting for the majority of associations is that it is a sub-brand. It's not necessarily replacing all of your education, but being very aware of, okay, where would it make sense to be boutique, and, you know, who is that clientele? What is that inventory that they're going to value? What is the passion that's taking us to serve this clientele with these products and services?
Right. And so, you know, practically speaking, if I'm, you know, listening to this from an organization, I think, okay, what do I do with this grand design thinking? What do I do with boutique learning? You know, I'd say on the design front, to start with some of the you know, the obvious and low-hanging fruit that your organization has, I think a great place to apply design thinking and then to parlay that into more of a grand design approach is to look at something like your conferences, you know, potentially put together a SWAT team of, you know, attendees, volunteers, your staff that are going to use that conference environment to really explore the possibilities and observe how people are engaging in that conference environment, how they're interacting with each other, talk to them about the experience, what's working, what's not, at a much deeper level than you get from just, you know, the standard evaluation that you get back from people, and figure out, you know, how could it be reconfigured? How could the sessions be reconfigured? How could the, you know, the overall conference agenda be reconfigured? And then, you know, to take it to more of that grand level, to start thinking outside the conference and saying, okay, how do we meaningfully link this into our online communities, into our online courses, start creating connections that aren't about an event, but that are about a process, and about, you know, an overall really movement, you know, to move the dial, as we've talked about in the learning that we're trying to provide for our sector. So, you know, start with something you've already got, really explore the possibilities there in an intentional way, looking at how, you know, actual human beings are interacting and learning, and then leverage out from there.
And I think in terms of boutique learning, what you can do is begin to think about, okay, where would it make sense to focus our efforts? What do we have that unique expertise in? Where would we be most valued? And I will say, you just mentioned conferences in terms of starting with grand design thinking. The one thing I will say about boutique learning is I don't think it implies anything about particular format. I mean, you know, I don't think this is, if we think too much about, you know, big box retailers versus boutique retailers, you may be thinking place-based, but I think it can happen online.
Right, and I think that's true with both of these, yeah. Don't get too wed to any sort of format. You've got possibilities, basically, so explore those possibilities.
And so obviously this leaves a lot of room for you to plug in. You know, we're just bringing the kind of big picture predictions. You have to do the work to translate and apply them in your organization. But I think it's going to be really exciting in the years to come to see whether these predictions pan out, how they pan out, as we think they will evolve. And I'm just really excited about the potential for learning and the lifelong learning market.
It's an amazing time to be involved in the world of learning and education, and specifically in this world of lifelong learning that we are involved in. And of course, we are going to continue to talk about it week after week here on the Leading Learning Podcast. And you know, we'll say once again, as we always do, that you can get show notes, and I do recommend getting the show notes for this episode, because we've, you know, referenced quite a few things that we will link to, and that's something we do in the show notes, so you can get links to things that we've talked about here, and also, you know, we provide notes just to help you kind of get through and review and reflect on what's been said. So if you want to get those show notes, please visit leadinglearning.com/episode 17. And while you're there, of course, pay attention to the subscription options if you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, because you can get this very conveniently delivered to your smartphone or other device of choice. So take advantage of subscribing to the podcast.
And also, please take a minute to give us a rating on iTunes. You can go to leadinglearning.com/iTunes. We'd really appreciate that. It makes a world of difference. We like hearing from you, and it also helps others find the podcast.
And we've said at least a few times during the podcast today that learning is a social experience. We hope you will share this in your network. We make that easy for you to do. All you have to do is go to leadinglearning.com/share, and that will pop up a tweet that you can just send right out, or you can change the language in it. If you're not into tweeting, you can take that same language and take it over to Facebook, take it to LinkedIn, wherever you want to, and share it with others. But we do ask you to please spread the word about the Leading Learning Podcast.
Thank you, and we'll see you next time on the Leading Learning Podcast.